This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Reversing the opioid freefall. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Dayton, Ohio has made tremendous progress in slowing the number of overdoses. Find out the strategies that are working.
Home health care workers are in high demand, but that's not helping their pay. Many still work a second job to make ends meet.
Mail-in ballots were supposed to help Florida's election process, but only made it worse. Can things be fixed before 2020?
And the latest trend in office interiors? Privacy pods in those open floor plans.
Some of them are resemble traditional phone booths and even have that the look of the famous ones in England that are cherry red. Others are more space age like. They look like little spaceships.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman on the most popular spot in the office these days. She's here in about 20 minutes. For the first time in years, the CDC says the number of opioid deaths nationwide has begun to dip. The flattening curve, along with declining opioid prescription rates, is the first encouraging news in a while. While it's too soon to know if the improvement is part of a long-term trend, it is clear there are some lessons to be learned from Dayton, Ohio, where there's been roughly a 50% decline in opioid overdoses. The New York Times spent several days there interviewing police and public health officials. Here's healthcare reporter Abby Goodenough. Abby, what'd you find?
Dayton is a place that this year has seen a really considerable drop in the number of overdose deaths, which when I saw a couple months ago got me really curious about why. You know, it just jumped out as a place where things had dropped particularly dramatically. Good. So I went to visit and ask a bunch of people there why they thought this was happening.
Yeah, because this is not some statistic that falls within some margin of error or something. I mean, this is like a 50% drop.
Right, and earlier in the year it was even bigger, like 65% drop. So we hadn't seen anything like that anywhere for a really long time, especially in a city that had had, you know, such a bad problem the previous year and the year before that regularly the morgue did not have enough space to fit bodies from people who had died of overdoses. They had to call in all kinds of help from neighboring communities. They, like the police chief told me, it was a tsunami.
Wow.
So something had changed.
All right. So what has? Are there a number of things folks point to?
There are all kinds of things. Particularly, they've really worked hand-in-hand law enforcement and public health, which doesn't always happen. You see a lot of communities where the police and the public health people tend to fight about the best tactics. But in this case, in Dayton, they really worked together and agreed that using what they call harm reduction tools was the best approach. And that's things like using Narcan to reverse overdoses and save lives, using needle exchanges to make sure people have clean needles, so that cuts the risk of hepatitis C and endocarditis and all kinds of other things you can die of. Even experimenting with fentanyl test strips, which are these strips you can use to test a drug before you actually use it to see if it's got some particularly lethal elements in it or not.
Oh my goodness.
Everybody agreed that rather than just trying to get everybody to stop using drugs altogether, they would work to overall try to prevent deaths. And obviously they want people to stop using drugs too and to get addiction treated, but their main priority across the board was trying to save lives.
Boy. We're speaking with Abby Goodenough, New York Times healthcare reporter. Her piece is called "This City's Overdose Deaths Have Plunged. Can Others Learn from It?" And she paid a visit to Dayton, Ohio to speak with folks there. Any other cities saying, hey, we've seen that, we're going to start adopting some of those practices?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's other cities around the country that are seeing, you know, somewhat striking drops in their overdose death numbers too. And whole states, Massachusetts, Vermont, in particular have seen promising drops this past year. Vermont as a whole state has worked really hard with some of these harm reduction tools to make a difference. I know the police chief in Burlington is really on board with them. What we're not seeing necessarily is a real end to the trafficking, the supply side, and the amount of fentanyl and fentanyl analog drugs that are out there for sale and still being passed around and used in a lot of places. So that's a lot harder to really stop.
You know, I thought it was fascinating as I was reading the story, and somebody you quoted in there talked, and I'm paraphrasing here, about drug dealers basically having products that are killing their clients, and that's a reason for the drop.
Now, that's a theory. I don't think that anybody knows that for sure, but it makes sense that if you put a bunch of carfentanil on the street, which is, it's used as an elephant tranquilizer. It's used to tranquilize really large animals. That's how powerful it is. And so if you're putting a lot of that on the street and suddenly a lot of the people buying your drugs are dying of it, you would think that people, the suppliers, would rethink what they're putting on the street. So perhaps that was a factor. It makes sense.
Somebody in your story, too, pointed to the expansion of Medicaid.
Right. Lots of people point to that. It's an obvious tool to make sure that, you know, all of these people, addiction tends to disproportionately affect lower income people, less educated people, although certainly it's across the board. But in this case, that was the population, the demographic that benefited from the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. We're talking, I believe, something close to 700,000 people across the state of Ohio received Medicaid insurance as a result of the expansion, and a big, big piece of that was access to addiction treatment.
Wow.
So the mayor of Dayton couldn't emphasize enough how much of a difference, particularly in the long term, that will make.
Thanks, Abby. That is New York Times healthcare reporter Abby Goodenough. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. About 10,000 people across Florida had their vote-by-mail ballot rejected by county elections offices for mismatched signatures or other forms of voter error during the midterm elections. The furor over rejected ballots has led elections officials and analysts to question why Florida has such strict rules for voting by mail compared with other states, including some states where all voting is done by mail, and to call for the legislature to take up the issue before the next election in 2020. Can things be fixed? Here's Stephen Lemangelo, political editor at the Orlando Sentinel. Stephen, recap what happened.
One of the issues that stretched across the entire state was the issue of mail-in ballots. Now, these were absentee ballots, ballots you can fill out and mail in. Was, you know, sold by Florida and by parties as, you know, making things much easier. You can vote from the comfort of your own home, things like that. But what it turned out was that around 10,000 people this year, and like thousands more in the past, had their ballots invalidated and rejected because of signature issues, either signature issues or some other sort of voter error, according to how Florida describes it. So essentially, people at your county supervisor of elections office would take a look at the signature on your envelope and then the signature that's in their files for your registration, and they would determine that, well, you know, this doesn't match, we're going to reject it. And now, supposedly, you know, you had ways of fixing it. You had ways of curing it. You could go to your website, fill out an affidavit, send copies of ID, and mail it back in. But the problem was the deadline for that to happen was the day before the election. So technically, people's deadline to fix their ballots was 24 hours before the deadline to even have ballots in on election day. So hundreds of people, you know, thousands of people possibly, were informed about their ballots being rejected or invalidated either the weekend before election day, the day before election day, election day, sometimes afterwards in the case of the 2016 Democratic Senate candidate, Patrick Murphy. He found out the day after the election, and there's really no way of them to fix it at that point.
Wow. So do other states who offer mail-in voting services have these types of issues?
Oh, no. In other states, especially Western states, like states like Washington, Oregon, their elections are entirely vote by mail. There's no in-person voting. And in places like that, you have weeks to fix it. In Washington, for example, you're up in 21 days after the election to fix any issues with the ballots. And they have, like, you know, teams of two going through the ballots, you know, trained by state police and signature verification. If there's an issue, if it goes through these two teams, they send you the form directly to fix it. They email you. They call you. They do whatever they can. And you have until 21 days after the election to fix it. Similarly, in California and Oregon and Colorado and things like that. So in no other states, really, like, well, in a few other states, do they have such strict restrictions as Florida did, where the deadline to fix the ballot is even before the deadline to receive the ballot.
Okay. So it's a matter of, like, a... I don't know, it's a screwy law compared to other states, or a handful of screwy restrictions that seem to mess things up?
It seems to be just a screwy law, just these severe restrictions in terms of, like, other states, for example, your mail-in ballot has to be postmarked by election day. So as long as on election day, you can walk in, put in the mailbox, put in the post office. As long as it's postmarked by election day, it still counts. You know, so they're still coming in New Jersey, for example, still coming in after election day. Here it has to be received in the elections office, the county elections office, by 7 p.m. on election day. It has to be in the office, which means that there could be issues with if there's something wrong with the post office, if the post office is late delivering it, if there was a bunch of ballots that were sort of left behind in a South Florida post office because of the bombs that were sent out from there a couple of weeks before the election, so they sort of sealed it off for a bit, and apparently a whole box of ballots just sort of got left there. If there's something wrong with if it sort of bounced back to you. I talked with one expert, and he said, like, you know, imagine the example here of two twin sisters, you know, putting their ballots in the mail on the same day, the same postage. You know, one gets bounced back and doesn't count, and the other goes through. And this all depends on the post office.
So what does this mean for, say, 2020? Can things get cleared up or simplified?
Well, one thing that the legislature could do, what they do in other states, like allow more time for people to fix it, like a couple of weeks or so, like, or even if not the 3 weeks they do in Washington, maybe like a week or two. They could allow, you know, allow ballots to be counted if they're postmarked by election day and not received by election day, so issues with the post office won't, you know, screw everything up for them. And frankly, a lot of people I've spoken to who had their ballots rejected say they're just not going to do that anymore. They're going to either vote in person or maybe they just won't vote at all. You know, a lot of people have said, like, that's the last time they're ever going to vote by mail. They're going to make sure to go in this time.
That's something. Wow. Until we all do it online, I guess, somehow, in some safe, secure fashion.
Yeah, like, it's quite possible. Hopefully, as technology improves, there might be, you know, better ways of doing it. But for now, like, this thing that was supposed to make it, you know, so easy for people to vote and so simple and so convenient, it turned out to be a nightmare for a lot of people.
Hey, Stephen Limoncello, political editor at the Orlando Sentinel. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at michiganbusiness.org. There's a new trend to combat the lack of privacy in some offices with open floor plans. Phone booths, kind of, without the phones. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
There's a growing backlash to those open office floor plans, the privacy pod. As Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal tells us, these enclosures are becoming quite the hot spot. Sarah, what do they look like?
They really vary. Some of them resemble traditional phone booths and even have the look of the famous ones in England that are cherry red. Others are more space age-like. They look like little spaceships. But mostly they're glass enclosures. They're small. They may have a little table and a stool or a bench.
So how many people could get in there?
Well, most of them are designed for one person, but there are larger ones that can accommodate two, or even I've seen a couple up to six. But the most common ones you'll see in the workplace are the single-person pods or the two-person pods.
Sarah, when did this concept begin, and what kinds of companies are using them?
Put it this way. In 2015, a single booth maker participated in the Neocon show in Chicago for the commercial design industry, and this year there were more than a dozen. So this is a trend that's been growing just over the past 3 years or so. And you'll see them in mostly traditional workplaces, offices, where there are open floor plans and employees are working very closely next to one another without any sort of partitions or very small partition.
All right. So, Sarah, what are people using them for?
Well, I mean, these booths are meant for private phone calls. So if you have a personal matter to take care of and you don't want your colleagues hearing you, you would go into these pods. But people are starting to use them for more than just that purpose. They're doing their jobs in the pods because the open floor plans are too distracting. So they're holing up in the pods. Most of them have signs. You know, a lot of employers put signs saying up to 30 minutes. You'll see people in there for way past that amount of time because they're so engaged in their day-to-day work, bringing their laptops. Some even will bring a snack with them and just sort of camp out.
We're speaking with Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal about the privacy pod at workplaces. Sarah, I know you talk to a lot of people who are using them and had to go to great lengths to snag one at their job. Can you talk about some of the people you spoke with?
You know, they're very popular, and companies may have only a couple of pods compared with, possibly hundreds of employees. So snagging an empty one can be hard. And, yeah, people are using them for more than just phone calls. They're doing their jobs in them. And so, some people are going to great lengths to get them. They're, camping outside the pods, waiting for one to open up. One woman told me that she resorted to bribery. She knocked on the door. The colleague inside the booth was one she had a good rapport with and jokingly said, I'll put your contract first in the queue if you give me your booth. This was an attorney. And she said, you have to be quick-footed or a good negotiator to get inside one.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending time with us on this first full weekend of December. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko. Coming up this half hour, it's not just Black Friday anymore. It's weeks of these discounts and bargains. Also, how do you manage all the holiday gift giving that's still ahead? And the church that handed out envelopes of $100 and $1,000 to give back to the community. We'll tell you what happened in about 20 minutes. Demand for home health aides, who provide the majority of hands-on non-medical care to older adults, is strong now and for the foreseeable future because of the aging baby boom generation, longer life expectancies, and growing rates of chronic conditions. In the next decade, the government says home care work is expected to add more jobs than any other occupation, with an additional 1.2 million needed by 2026. Yet home health care agencies can't find enough workers. Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. Claire, what'd you look at?
Well, we looked at, there's family caregivers who are not paid. It's relatives who take care of older family members, but not every family member can do that. And so there's a whole part of the workforce, and it's one of the fastest growing occupations, is direct care. And basically, these are people who provide non-medical care to people who want to live in their homes and in the community, but can't do so on their own. The demand is huge and the supply is low. And a big part of the reason for that is because the wages are low. And in this economy, which is strong, people can go to Wendy's or Amazon and make more for work that maybe is not so demanding physically and emotionally.
Yeah. I don't pretend to know what that work is like, but I have, I guess, a fair idea, right? You're helping somebody out of bed at times. Perhaps you're giving them a shower, cleaning them in the bathroom. Why does this pay so low?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Most of this care in the U.S. is based on reimbursements from Medicaid, and to a lesser extent, Medicare, and also to by private insurance and out of pay, out of people's pockets. The Medicare reimbursements have been flat or fallen across the country pretty much. Some states are trying to change that and up the wages, but when you have, in some cases, where the actual payment has fallen almost 2% since 2010, whereas costs have increased, multiplied by much more, it's hard to keep the wages high. And so it's really one of those things where, you know, your traditional economic theories and models of high demand and low supply should result in higher wages, but they don't. And the other issue, too, is perception. You know, this has long been a job that people have associated and kind of, you know, diminished by saying it's women's work or domestic help or glorified babysitting with little appreciation of the skills involved and the demands involved. So it's not valued. It's not valued. You know, a lot of people who work in this sector and provide workers say, you know, our culture simply does not value the work that is being done. It's as much as people need it.
It's incredible. I mean, these caregivers at times, right, either directly or indirectly, are probably lifesavers or life extenders, right? I mean, they're saints.
Yeah.
These are saints.
Right. And, you know, it's not like they're, they're not performing surgery or anything.
Yeah.
But, they, you know, really good ones are enhancing the quality of life of people at the end of their lives. And, you can't put a value on that.
Yeah. We're speaking with Claire Ansberry, Wall Street Journal columnist. Her piece is called Caregivers Do Double Duty to Make Ends Meet. That's a reference to some of them, if they're lucky, make $13 an hour, but generally it's less than that in the $11 hour range. Who are some of the folks you talked to in this story? Give us a profile, maybe one of them.
Well, you know, there was a woman, Yolanda Allen, and what struck me about her is she's been in the field for 35 years, and she makes $32,500 a year.
Jeez.
With overtime.
Wow.
And you have people coming out of school who, you know, if they're going to earn that their first year, that is not considered a really great paying job. And that's fresh out of school. And this is someone who's been doing it for 35 years. And her pay includes overtime. And this is a woman who puts her hand up for every hour of overtime and all of the holiday shifts.
It's almost unbelievable. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending some time with us. Thanksgiving weekend food, diet busting, right? Thanksgiving weekend retail sales, record breaking. That's the chorus being sung by retailers, industry groups, and data firms tracking holiday sales between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday. It's a story by Rachel Siegel, business reporter at The Washington Post. Rachel, what are you hearing?
Projected to be a pretty strong holiday season. You know, there's low unemployment, the economy is good, there's high consumer confidence, but there were still records broken left and right, really. Records broken for people that were buying specifically on their smartphones or the amount of money that was reeled in on Cyber Monday. So retailers are feeling pretty good over the five-day stretch between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday.
You know what jumped out at me, one of these stats in your story? There's an estimation that 165 million Americans shopped in stores and online from Thanksgiving to Cyber Monday, which was down from last year. How come?
Right. So it was down from last year. Last year, there were about 174 million Americans who turned out over that same period. But analysts are saying that that's actually because the holiday season is a bit longer this year. So there's an actual extra weekend between Thanksgiving and Christmas compared to last year. And they're actually saying that, you know, consumers are feeling so good that they don't necessarily feel this pressure to race to the stores on one weekend alone to get discounts, that they can space their shopping out a little bit.
Wow. How does Cyber Monday do? Is it still the single largest day?
Yeah, so Cyber Monday broke records again this year. You know, it's interesting. People are saying that Cyber Monday definitely still has the lure that people are, you know, definitely racing to get the deals. A record $7.9 billion was spent online this year. But they're actually saying, you know, that Cyber Monday deals are actually being spread out throughout the entire holiday season, that there isn't necessarily the same push to mark down discounts on Monday alone, but that you're seeing some of those lower discounted items a little bit earlier in the weekend, too.
We're speaking with Rachel Siegel, business reporter at the Washington Post. Her piece is called "It's Not Black Friday Anymore, It's Weeks of Discounts." If I understand some of the marketing lingo, perhaps Cyber Monday, seemingly, at least with some marketers, has turned into Cyber Week. Is that part of this?
Yeah, that's right. I was hearing that too. Cyber Week. And actually, I was told that, you know, some of the discounts that people were seeing on TV specifically, that you were seeing the same prices that were, you know, low throughout the whole weekend, actually starting on Thanksgiving Day. So, you know, not even necessarily starting on Black Friday, but even as early as Thursday.
How did Amazon do in all this? They're kind of tight-lipped with it, right?
That's right. So Amazon said that Cyber Monday was the biggest shopping day in the company's history, and that on Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined, that shoppers ordered more than 18 million toys, more than 13 million fashion items. But they don't exactly say what those numbers mean, and they wouldn't tell me, you know, exactly how much of a rise they saw over last year or exactly how much money was brought in. So it's kind of hard to quantify just as much or how much that rise was, but they are saying that they saw huge numbers. So.
Is there a suspicion, I guess, that most of these numbers, whether it's online shopping or mobile shopping, will just continue to grow? We haven't seen any kind of flattening out, have we?
The analysts are expecting that this kind of success is going to continue through the rest of the year, through Christmas and through New Year's. And so people are feeling confident going into 2019.
Thanks, Rachel. It's Rachel Siegel, business reporter at The Washington Post. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, don't forget, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter at Gordon Deal. Instead of joy and generosity of spirit portrayed in holiday movies, the Yuletide season often comes with emotional and financial stress as people navigate budgets, family expectations, and guilt. Americans are expected to spend a little more than $1,000 on average this holiday season, a 4% jump from last year. Almost two-thirds of that spending will be on gifts. That's a stretch for many household budgets, and some families across the country are working around it. It's a story by USA Today personal finance reporter Jana Herron. Jana, set the scene.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people feel this way. I think the stats out there are saying we're supposed to spend $1,000 this year for the holidays, and that's including travel, food, and gifts. So I think a lot of people are thinking this is too much for my pocketbook and I need to do something about it. So a lot of the people I talked with had different ideas. Either they turned to handmade gifts if they were very good professionally when it comes to making stuff, like the potter that I talked to in Wilmington, North Carolina. And then other people have decided to re-gift some of the things that they have that maybe they don't need anymore, but would be really special for someone else. For example, one lady who had changed careers. She's giving her professional wardrobe to her little sister, who is just graduating from college and is starting her first job.
Wow. Can you go over the board or do the wrong thing with, say, re-gifting or repurposing?
I think you can. You don't want to just give something that you have that has no thought behind it. So I think that's the reason why this one example works really well, because this is something that she knew her sister needs and helps her sister get ahead without having to spend a whole lot of money on a new wardrobe. But if you're just simply going into your closet, grabbing something, and wrapping it up, I don't think that's going to be very special. But if you have a nice piece of jewelry that you don't wear anymore, or a family heirloom that you want to give to the younger generation, I think those are really thoughtful gifts.
Speaking of the younger generation, did it seem to be mostly millennials who were trying to do something slightly off the beaten path here?
I did talk to a couple of millennials, but I also talked to people who had, you know, teenage children and they had families, but they also needed to worry about their own budget. So mothers, grandmothers as well. It hits everybody. And I think, as we've seen, the holidays become very commercial and we see all these sales and we talk about Black Friday and things like that, but the takeaway I got is a lot of these people just really want to spend time with their family in a meaningful way and not stress out about getting the right gift.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jana Herron, personal finance reporter at USA Today. Her piece is called Budgets, Family Drama, and Stuff. How do you avoid holiday overspending and perhaps the stress that goes with it? I think one of the important things you mentioned, too, is start the conversation, right? Let there be no guesswork, basically, about this.
That's right. If you're having a hard year when it comes to money, it's better just to be upfront about that. And you know what? there's a good chance that some other family members are feeling the same way. So maybe you guys can come up with something different to do, like some kind of gift exchange game. That's what my family does, and it's a lot of fun. And it really keeps a cap on how much you have to spend, but it really is a great bonding experience.
Thanks, Jana. That is USA Today personal finance reporter Jana Herron. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, glad you're with us, a men's group at a Baptist church in Georgia decided to give away money as a blessing to the community. About 80 families at the Sandy Valley Baptist Church received envelopes with amounts between $100 and $1,000 with one simple instruction: take it home and open it with your family and talk about the ways you can bless someone. CJ Holmes, head of Project Multiply, as it's called, told Fox News that one family bought a bunch of blankets, gloves, and some fast food gift cards and gave them to homeless people with information on the shelters in town. A couple of people joined their amounts together to help pay medical bills for a family member of the church who was going through chemotherapy. Another lady was shopping in a grocery store when she saw a woman with a cart filled with food and supplies. Turns out the shopper was picking up stuff for homeless people and veterans, so the church money was used to pay for those supplies. A number of families in the church matched the amount they had received and gave it to someone in need in their community. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.